Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The death of actor Corey Monteith this past weekend from a fatal mix of alcohol and heroin is only in the headlines because he was a star. It turns out the fresh-faced actor was part of a new wave of heroin users, far-flung, suburbs, small towns, high schoolers, 30-somethings, taking up a very dangerous drug that's become cheap and highly accessible, but no less deadly, out of Latin America, out of Afghanistan, and almost certainly these days in your town. This hour On Point, heroin all over. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Have you seen it? Has heroin touched you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's just hear that voice for a second. Remember Corey Monteith? Here he was, playing football star turned Glee Club member as Finn Hudson on the Fox hit Glee.
I'll stand by you. I'll stand by you. Won't let nobody hurt you. I'll stand by
you. Well, that's all done. He's dead at 31. Joining us first today from Vancouver, Canada, where Corey Monteith died, is Tiffany Crawford, reporter for the Vancouver Sun. Tiffany, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here we are reading Vancouver, a city known by some as the heroin capital of North America. How did you get that reputation, Tiffany?
Oh, I think there's a lot of factors at work. For one thing, it's a port city. There's a lot of heroin coming in from Southeast Asia. The other thing is we have one of the milder climates, so there's a lot of people moving here, a lot of homeless people. We do also have a very high cost of housing, so a lot of people on the streets.
Corey Monteith was anything but homeless, and we're reading in this country a lot about it, not being just an urban problem and not a street person, old-fashioned sort of junkie image problem, but all over the place. I'm reading you writing just in the last couple of days about many deaths beyond Corey Monteith's in your region.
Well, that's right, and I think you hit the mark there. It's cheap. It's available. We've had 30 deaths so far in Vancouver this year. A warning from health officials last month saying that, and one of the problems is it's being spiked with other drugs, and fentanyl is one of the biggest problems here right now. So was there a bad batch going around? We don't know. We're still waiting for a final coroner's report, but it looks like there's been 7 deaths already out in another city just south of here. So we are looking at a very high problem here.
Plenty going around. How are, city fathers and mothers and responding to this? You've got this harm reduction model in Vancouver with a safe injection site. What's that mean? What is that?
We do. It's called Insight. It was set up in 2003, and what it is it's a safe place for drug users to go. They take their own drugs. They can safely inject there. And but it's also centered around addiction treatment and services as well, so people can go in and also get help there.
Injection, though, seems to be less popular than before. Snorting, smoking, a lot more currency these days.
Right, of course, yes. And, of course, they can do that there as well, at the injection site.
Is that working, or are those just magnets for users? I mean, can anybody walk in and say, hey, I'd like to snort some heroin?
Showing that it is working. It's interesting because our own federal government tried to shut the project down. Took it to court. Supreme Court ruled 2 years ago that they had to leave it open. And, a 15-year study has shown that, in 1996, there was, 40% of drug users were using heroin. That's gone down to 1.7 in 2011. So it looks like, they're pointing to Insight as something that is working.
Lots of sort of high-profile users, of course, over the years. Charlie Parker, John Belushi, River Phoenix, Coco Chanel, you name it, who have ended badly with heroin. How's the city taking on board Corey Monteith's death?
Oh, I mean, this is, like you said, is a city grappling with drug abuse. So it did come as a shock when you have this young person who's clearly, you know, not, as you said, homeless, in a different social class. And I think that, well, one of the things that's really come out here, and one of our prominent addiction doctor, Dr. Evan Wood, has said that, you know, kids need to remember that they, because of the stigma around it, they're going and doing these things alone, and they're drinking and mixing it alone, and they won't know how to respond or call for help if they're mixing the two intoxicants.
And if you're alone, you're at risk no matter what. Alone, you can really be in trouble. Most of these deaths are from suffocation. People stop breathing.
That's right. These substances work on different parts of the brain, apparently, and shut down the respiratory center in the brain. So the breathing starts to slow, and then it stops. And they aren't aware that they need to call for help. And this is what when the overdose happens. And you know, so where you have a lot of perhaps people in the downtown east side, which is an area where a lot of drug users are going to places that are safe, like Insight, you may have a lot of younger people that are doing the drugs. It's happening, but they're staying at home, and they're doing it alone because they don't want the stigma of going down to somewhere like Insight.
And by no means just in Vancouver, Canada, all over the U.S. at this point, in lots of settings that we haven't in our sort of historical stereotypes associated with heroin use. Tiffany Crawford is a reporter for the Vancouver Sun in Vancouver, Canada, where, of course, Corey Monteith died over the weekend. Tiffany, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
When it's bad, it's very bad. Here's a little tape of Craig Knapper. He lost his job and his fiance when he became addicted to heroin. Ended up in prison at age 25. Here, this is from a Discovery Channel show, First Week In. He explains how he's feeling as he goes through withdrawal in his first week in prison. Withdrawal from heroin.
I don't even get high anymore. I just do it so I can feel normal. I'm starting to get withdrawals, and it's starting to take effect now since I haven't used in almost 12 hours. You start getting cold, hot. You start sneezing a lot. Nose starts running, vomiting. You can't get comfortable. Imagine being physically sick with the flu, just where you don't want to move. Your bones ache, your body aches, your stomach hurts. You just feel like throwing up. You just drained of everything physically.
No fun at all. Their withdrawal from heroin being described. With us now from Seattle, Washington, is Caleb Banta-Green, research scientist and epidemiologist at the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute at the University of Washington Medical Center, assistant professor at the university's School of Public Health. Last year, served as a science advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Caleb Banta-Green, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, Tom.
Hi. Describe the pattern of heroin abuse. I mean, we're reading here 80% up since 2002 among high school users. That sounds like a big spike. But has it come back from the low in the 80s, 90s when people were worried about AIDS and needles?
We probably haven't quite seen that yet, but all the signs are that we're really headed that direction. You know, we look at deaths, thankfully, and ultimately the lagging indicator, the tip of the iceberg that comes quite a bit later. But we're seeing a lot of other warning signs over the last decade, such as drug treatment admissions and evidence that police are getting off the street, really a supply indicator. And those things are all pointing to increases. And some of the detailed work we've done in Washington State, obviously you would see supply increasing, then you would see treatment increasing. Admissions increasing. And then most recently, we're just starting to see the first sign in 2012, really of heroin deaths beginning to increase. And those deaths are entirely due to people under the age of 30. So the increase is driven by the people under the age of 30.
I mean, so nationally, certainly up plenty. In 2009, the most recent numbers I've got here, 510 teens and young adults dying of heroin overdose, up from 198 10 years earlier. So that's up. Everybody talks about the OxyContin and its cousins and the use of those somehow opening up a path to heroin. What's that dynamic, Caleb?
Yeah, that's a little bit complex. Let's talk about it. You know, if you look at a molecule of oxycodone and you look at a molecule of heroin, they look virtually identical. And that's on purpose. That's how oxycodone was engineered, was to try to be a safer alternative. So biochemically to the brain, they're essentially the same thing. We've had about a 300% increase in the prescribing of opiates over the last 15 years, in the United States. And that was purposeful. That was because there was a belief in the medical community that we were under-treating pain mm-hmm. and that strong opiate medicines were the appropriate response to that. In fact, a public health and a medical response to the under-treatment of pain. The pendulum is certainly swinging back the other way. What we see, though, is that with the increased availability of prescription opiates, there's also an increase in the diverted market and an increase, therefore, in the abuse of those prescription opiate medicines. In sort of a complex way, people get exposed to prescription opiates. Adolescents often are using them in kind of a party context. They seem like a safe thing to do. They're kind of fun. The big issue is that 20, 30 years ago, most people weren't going to be exposed to opiates. So even if some proportion of the population was predisposed to liking opiates, most of them weren't going to have access. Now many more people have access. And so more people who would naturally have used opiates, if they were available, are using them. We have this policy and practice thing within the medical community of reining back into prescription opiates. That's having some positive intended consequences. In Washington State, we saw the first decline in high schoolers reporting use of prescription opiates to get high in 2012. So that's good that that came back down.
But the unintended consequence of one of them may be people moving on to heroin now can be more accessible and cheaper than the sort of unintended use of those prescription opiates, and we've got an issue here. Caleb Bantagreen, please stand by in Seattle. It's great to have you with us. We're talking about the spread and evolution of heroin use in this country. Goodbye, Corey Monteith, right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the spread and evolution of heroin use, the new faces and places of heroin after the death by overdose of actor Corey Monteith. It's getting people's attention. Of course, if you see it firsthand, it may have your attention already. Caleb Bantagreen is with us from the University of Washington Medical Center. Here's a young recovering heroin addict named Mike sharing on YouTube how easy it is to fall prey to relapse when he tries to get off, from a video titled Suburban Heroin.
A lot of times you go through withdrawal and you start to feel a little bit better. You're coming out of the withdrawal and you say, you know, every heroin addict's been there where they say, all right, I'm done. I'm never going through this again. And then, you know, a couple days goes by and you start feeling better and you feel back to normal and you just forget how bad it feels.
Just how bad it feels and how quickly people go back. I mean, Corey Monteith was just not long at all out of rehab, Caleb, when he went right back. Do people understand going into heroin, how hard it is to get out?
No. I mean, absolutely not. Nobody goes into it knowing that's what's going to happen. And people use drugs because at the front end, they feel good. And as both of the heroin users you've brought on, you know, you've mm-hmm. had on the show here mm-hmm. have said, it feels good at first. And then you just try not to feel terrible. So that draw is really, really strong. And you could imagine, doesn't matter if you're hooked on prescription opiates or heroin, or if you are on prescription opiates and you can't get them, you would use heroin to not feel that terrible.
I mean, we've got people writing in from all over the place with experiences. Vito writes to us, a bag of heroin is cheaper than a pack of cigarettes. Now, it's cheaper on the street, I'm reading here, than OxyContin or Codeine these days. But, gosh, that talk about availability, cheaper than a pack of cigarettes. I want to go right to the people who see it happening. Caleb, stand by in Seattle. Thomas in Plattsburgh, New York. Thanks for calling, Thomas. You're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. As I'm a young high school student, I'm about to go into my senior year, and I actually moved to a rural area about 40 minutes from Canada, from a city, from actually Baltimore. And I've seen more heroin, prescription drug use, and marijuana use in this small community than I ever saw when I lived in a very, you know, a city that has this reputation for being very lawless. And so I think it's definitely more accessible in these communities where everyone knows everyone.
So if everybody knows everyone, who's dealing?
Well, I think it ranges from adults that are trusted. I mean, it varies. I think there are kids, though. We've had kids in school. And I think also what's happened is there's no longer the taboo attached to drug use, which is sad. I mean, marijuana has become very prevalent in recent years. And I think people are no longer... as I don't want to use this word, but as afraid of drugs as they used to be.
Unafraid, but still utterly vulnerable when things go bad. I appreciate your call right there in high school, in the burbs, beyond the burbs. Let me get one more right here from Worcester, Massachusetts. Liam. Liam, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a great show, and I'm glad you're having it because people should talk about this a lot more. This subject is very serious to me. I'm 23 years old, and I've had, like, I have to say, like, 50% of my friends all around me, all wrecked by heroin addiction, and it started with the OxyContin use, and it's terrible.
So you really see that link, Liam, between OxyContin and heroin use?
Oh, I see the link as clear as day. I know it. I know that that's how it starts. It starts, the kids do it, and then they get addicted, and it's like... I forget his name, but what he said earlier, he'd rather do the heroin than feel as terrible from the withdrawal.
And are they just rolling with it, or are they getting messed up?
I don't know. I don't know. I honestly think that this is, like, the scourge of my generation. Like, it happened in a flash. I don't know. I'm very emotional about it because, it's just a terrible thing, and I just see it happening all around me, and I don't see it getting any better.
And happening so quickly. Liam, I really appreciate your call as well. Caleb, lots of sources here. We've talked on this show before about black tar heroin coming up out of Latin America, Mexico. But there are many people asking, and you can see the reporting here, about Afghanistan as well. I mean, Marcus writes to us on Facebook, says the rise in heroin is due to our war in Afghanistan. Talk about it, he says. Talk about corruption at all levels. What do we know about that source? I am reading here that Afghanistan's production has gone from 150 metric tons in 02, important date, to 664 metric tons in 06, and presumably still growing. Does that come to the U.S., Caleb?
No, most of that does not come to the U.S. Most of the heroin that we get in the United States comes from Colombia or comes from Mexico. There absolutely is a worldwide heroin market. And what I would just say about that is opiates and heroin are kind of a universal thing. And it's because our brain has opiate receptors in them. So it happens to be most of our heroin does not come from that region. People obviously have strong political opinions. I think, though, that what we're talking about is a real serious medical condition. And I think it's important people know that it is a desperate situation. The drug treatment works. Medication-assisted treatment with things like Suboxone or methadone can keep people alive and return them to functioning. And for people who are using, we can keep them alive with overdose prevention. So I hope we can speak to that as well.
Well, I mean, I take that. But if it works, why is Corey Monteith right out of rehab and overdosed and dead?
Well, a couple things there. Rehab, any interruption in use. Rehab, detox, jail is a very dangerous time. If a person goes in using a gram, they haven't used in a week or two, they come back out, use a gram, their body has lost their adaptation to it, and they die. So the point is a person really ideally is coming out. What we know saves lives is keeping people on medication-assisted treatment. Things like Suboxone or methadone that don't get a person high but keep them from having that craving and that withdrawal. And we know that those medications work. They're increasingly available, and it's something people should definitely be learning about, are those medication-assisted treatments.
Let's talk to somebody who it looks like maybe in the middle of this right now. Raven is calling from New York City. Raven, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for having me. How are you doing?
Fine. What's going on with you, Raven?
Well, it's been about 8 years into this. I'm actually on my way to pick up right now.
Pick up
what? City. I worked at a a bank for a while, and it doesn't really discriminate, and it's very, very difficult to stop. And you can continue to be successful to some degree while continuing that lifestyle, and it's just a very difficult to get off. I agree, Suboxone can be extremely helpful. However, if you don't continue using that responsibly, you can continue your problem.
Raven, let me just be very clear. You're on your way to pick up heroin right now?
That is correct.
Are are you high now, or are you off of it, or are you?
No, I'm not high right now, which is why I'm going to pick up right now.
And what does it cost?
It costs about $150 for a gram.
And is a gram like a night of partying or a day, or I have no idea?
Sir, I wouldn't call it partying.
Okay.
I'd call it sustaining.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, you're quite right. I stand fully corrected.
Yeah.
Is that a day? Is that 2 days? Is that a week? What is that for you?
It would be about a day, yeah. So, the cheapness starts at the beginning, and then once you're in it, and it's no longer just an every now and then thing, the cost becomes a significant problem.
Are you still a banker, Raven?
Yes, I am.
And your employer doesn't know, I guess, or
No, they do not.
So what's your plan? I mean, you're pretty.
Well,
the hook is in pretty deep, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's difficult. The plan is always to stop. And as a previous caller had mentioned, once you stop, then you're like, that maybe I'm okay again, and it just completely draws you back. Your brain chemistry definitely changes. And you're never the same again. But, my plan is to stop. It's not a sustainable life.
Caleb, do you have any advice for Raven? It sounds like she's tried some of these substitutes that you've mentioned. Suboxone, she's still on.
Well, it's a great thing that she mentioned, and that she said Suboxone really can do well by a person as long as they stay on it, and there can't be cost issues with that. There actually are national health policy issues around whether states are going to cover adequately drug treatment and whether they're going to cover adequately medication-assisted treatment. So certainly, I would encourage her to reach out to people who can give her support and help her not use, and if she does need to use today, do things to stay safe. So really reaching out, people getting Suboxone or methadone when they can is really important. Those are life-sustaining drugs.
Raven, what do you say to others in your circle or around you who may reach for heroin that first time? What do you say to them?
It's never the same again. It's the worst decision I ever made in my life.
Hey, Raven, dig down and find your way off of it. We hope for that, and I appreciate your candor with us today. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Good luck to you. Stan in Florence, South Carolina. Stan, you're on the air.
Hello. I buried my son in December of last year from an overdose of heroin. He died in Charleston, South Carolina. He was at a known heroin dealer's address. We returned with the police to see where he died. And, of course, the police didn't do anything. We smelled marijuana when we came in, and then I showed them a residence where my son told me he had purchased heroin from, and they said they would see what they could do. I would have thought they would have done some immediately, but the entire city is flooded with the drug, and it is cheaper than oxycodone, and people who take pain pills end up taking heroin because it's cheaper and more available.
Stan, I am so sorry for your family. That's as bad as it gets. Did you see it coming? Did you know that your son was on heroin?
I knew he had used on and off, but I had no idea that he was an addict. He had to live with us for about 4 weeks before he died. He seemed very functional and that he was okay. But, I could have been totally blind to him maintaining a habit. It's something that maybe I just didn't understand. I don't know. It's like that girl, I guess, that's going to work today or going to buy heroin now. She must be just maintaining. But I missed it, and there's a lot of it out there, and it's killing a lot of people.
Stan, our heart really goes out to you, and I appreciate your sharing that with us, and we wish some comfort to your family. Thank you for your call, Stan.
Okay.
Thank you. Stan in Florence, South Carolina. Son died at 27. Just last year. With us right now from Providence, Rhode Island, is Dr. Josiah Jody Rich, attending physician at the Miriam Hospital in Providence. A lot of expertise in addiction. Jody Rich, Dr. Josiah Rich, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's quite an honor.
I'm reading all over the country here. You can find it. You name the part of the country, and it's there. And it's not, we heard from Raven in New York, but it's in small towns. I'm reading it right in my backyard here. Death upon death just in this month from heroin in relatively small towns. People are saying cheap, powerfully addictive, of course. Are you seeing this evolution, sort of heroin everywhere and so accessible, Dr. Rich?
So, Tom, let me just clarify some basic things.
Yes, please.
Yes, I certainly am seeing that. And the CDC just put out a notice that for, I think, something like the 15th year in a row, the overdose death rates have increased. You know, we're experiencing a tremendous public health disaster, the likes of we haven't seen since the early AIDS epidemic, or the AIDS epidemic itself, here in the U.S. and also around the globe.
Yeah.
The disease is opiate addiction. And as Dr. Banta Green said, mm-hmm. you know, those receptors, they don't care if it's heroin or morphine or
Oxy.
Mm-hmm. It is a consistent disease. And clinically, when I see someone, I mean, you had that quote of a patient saying, I don't even get high anymore.
Yeah.
I thought I was just hearing one of my patients. The disease is very consistent, and it's kind of like somebody with Down syndrome. I mean, you look at them, it doesn't matter if they're black or white or rich or poor. There's something easily recognizable and consistent about all of them.
You can see a heroin user just by looking at them?
Well, I don't mean see visually like in Down syndrome,
okay.
But I mean, I ask the questions of my patients, and I know what the answer is going to be before they even say it, because yeah. It's the same answer, and I hear it over and over again. So this is a chronic, relapsing, deadly brain disease.
And they start out partying, and I use that way too casually with Raven in New York, but as she said and you say, very quickly it becomes just to feel decent, just to feel normal.
That's exactly right. I just want to feel normal. Doc, I don't even get high anymore. But our brains are programmed for survival of the individual and survival of the species. We have this sort of primitive reptilian brain deep inside our brainstem.
Yeah.
And then we have our cortex, what we use to think with.
Mm-hmm.
So that reptilian brain is really in charge of survival. It makes sure we breathe. It makes sure we eat. It makes sure we drink. It makes sure we're interested in sex.
Yeah.
These are primal instincts, and even more than instincts. They're controlling factors. You can tell yourself not to breathe, and that's not going to last very long because the reptilian brain...
So what's all that have to do with heroin?
Well, opiate addiction hijacks that and changes the brain. So once somebody has become addicted to opiates, they change the pathways. The disease in their brain, and you can see this on neuroimaging studies,
mm-hmm.
the brain lights up in different and responds in different ways. So it becomes as if this is a basic survival mechanism. And as Raven was saying, she's just surviving. She's just getting by. She's not getting high. As the other patient said, I don't get high anymore.
I mean, our listener Katie writes here on Facebook, you know, stupid, stupid, and more stupid. What about that higher part of the brain? What power does it have to come in here and help fix this, Dr. Rich?
Well, a lot of people don't understand, you know, they don't understand addiction. And I would add the medical profession as well. You know, we're not trained very well in how to recognize and deal with it. But, yes, there is treatment. Treatment works. The medication-assisted treatment seems to work much better. What I tell my patients is, you know, that medication can help you get that monster off your back. And it is a monster. You know, there are two things that have been sort of hinted at during the conversation
yep.
that develop when you start. And somebody typically would start, you know, they might start to get high. They might start because they got a prescription for something they injured themselves. And they took them, and then they kind of liked that
the
feeling.
The painkiller, yeah.
More.
Yeah.
And then they tell the doctor, well, it's still hurting. I need some more. And then eventually the doctor wises up and then shuts them off. And then they start getting them some from the grandmother's medicine cabinet and from
yeah.
their friends. And then pretty soon they figure out that it's heroin's cheaper and transition over.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the spread and evolution of heroin use, the new faces and places of heroin after the death by overdose of actor Corey Monteith. Caleb Banta Green is with us from Seattle, Washington, at the University of Washington Medical Center there. He served as senior science advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Dr. Josiah Rich is with us from Providence, Rhode Island. attending physician at the Miriam Hospital, a lot of expertise and experience of people with addiction there. Jordy Rich, Caleb Antiguin, lots of reaction here from all over the country. Here's one, again, not far from me. Tom says, I'm in a small town in central Massachusetts, walking around. I've seen 6-7 needles on the sidewalk, pulled into Whole Foods parking lot in Providence, got out of the car, looked down, 3 needles. The love of my life, it turned out, was a junkie. After 5 months in prison last year, she didn't last 2 weeks in rehab. I check the obituaries daily. And here's another, FNM writes to us on Twitter, says, parent, how much can you put in a tweet? A lot. Parent of addicts, can't believe anything they say. Pot, not the same as H. Talk about Portugal, please. And Ibogaine, I don't know what that is. What about dealing with addicts and trying to get them to help, Dr. Rich?
So when somebody's taking an opiate regularly, they pretty quickly develop a tolerance. That means they need to use a higher dose to get the same effect. And then they also develop the withdrawal phenomenon. And that's sort of a diabolical combination because it predicts that you would need more and more and more in order to continue using. And it also, you can't stop because you'll get terribly sick. That was a great description, the worst flu you ever had in your life,
yeah.
Except it's 10 times worse. It's like a boa constrictor just wrapping around you, and every time you breathe out, it tightens.
Oof.
You can't escape it.
Yeah.
But when you do escape it, when you go through detox, as unfortunately Mr. Scorey did, or when you get incarcerated, and then you come out, that is a very dangerous time because you again have lost your tolerance. And as Dr. Bantagreen said, if you take a gram regularly, you can tolerate it. Then you stop even for a day.
I see. And you think, oh, I can do this. This is about right. And boom, it knocks you down.
Well, it's not even thinking. It's not. That's okay. Not cerebral. This is, again, the primitive brain thinking you need this for survival.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell people, and I don't think he wanted to overdose. I don't think he was, this is not something...
not a suicide attempt.
Not a suicide by any means. This is something that the body takes over and does it. You don't know why you did it. You can't explain it. You can't understand it. Your family can't understand it. The general public can't understand it. So, yes, there is treatment. If you occupy that receptor with methadone, with Suboxone, if you block that receptor with other medications, you can get through that. Now, I tell patients, you need to get into recovery. And recovery is kind of like a compass heading. When you're addicted, you develop, you know, we heard it, they lie and they cheat and they steal. And in fact, there's really 3 things that people get into, most people, one or a combination to survive. I mean, you heard $150 a day just to get through the day.
Yeah.
Who has that kind of money?
Yeah, not a good situation in any way. Jordy Rich, stand by there. Yeah. Caleb Bantagreen. Tom in Omaha, Nebraska is calling. Tom, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention that, my story, I'm 30 years old now.
Okay.
And I started using just OxyContin when I was 18 in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And by age 20, I had gotten on needles and contracted HIV from that at age 20.
Yeah.
And then that caused even more use all the way through my 20s and went pretty far downhill until about 3 years ago or so, I went to rehab, and that didn't actually do much. I went to rehab for months and then just, like, went right back to it. And But then I went to the methadone clinic because I really desperately wanted to stop and could not. And it's not a choice when you're in the depths of that distance. And sorry, what?
Well, Tom, I want to hear where that story goes, but let me just ask you, what about the availability in Omaha, the Omaha area, of heroin? Is it hard to get? You'd have to be living on the edge to know how to find it?
Absolutely not. No, it's definitely available. Yeah, I know several people that are on it and several people that have quit. And yeah, it's all over the place.
And beyond yourself and your circle of friends, did you see the imprint of it?
Well, yes. Actually, when I was using, I actually sold pills a lot. And I think of heroin and OxyContin as identical. Like, I don't think of them as much different at all, except for what they're called.
Wow.
And, I used to sell pills, and it was insane the different kinds of people you would see doing these that still, you know, are out there, like attorneys, teachers, even a local news anchor. Like, it's...
Oh, we remember back in the day when Rush Limbaugh had his problem, his addiction. And
yeah,
I mean, it's anybody can be hit by it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was, are you off now, Tom? Did you manage to kick it?
Yes, yeah. And the way I managed to do it finally was a methadone clinic in town here. And I am so incredibly grateful for that clinic. It has saved my life completely, because I'm still on methadone to this day, and it has saved my life completely. And I would like to say to anyone out there that's listening that is in the depths of that kind of an addiction, it feels hopeless, but really, yeah, that it can, it, there is a way out. And it's like your guest was saying about Suboxone or methadone is my way that I did it. So,
Tom, big respect to you for getting on that recovery path, and you stay right on it. And I really appreciate your call. Caleb Bantagreen, what about that? You know, Tom in Omaha draws a direct line between the oxy drugs and heroin. He says to him, there's no difference. Is it the same effect? Is it the same addictive quality, Caleb?
Absolutely. I mean, they're interchangeable. So it really is the same effect. And
but doctors give you oxy this and oxy that. So people must think, well, you know, the doctor gave it to me.
Well, I mean, a quick aside here. I mean, opium is a miracle drug. When it was originally found and used as a tea, it cures diarrhea, cough, pain. There's a reason it's used as a medicine. It can be a good medicine if it's well managed. But for some people, it gets totally out of control.
I guess we see plenty of that. Kathy in Stoneham, Massachusetts, close to home again. Kathy, you're on the air.
Okay, hi. All my life in Massachusetts, I've seen drug addiction from the time I was nine. But back in 1995, I lost a child, and I could not stop crying. And my then husband, he brought home heroin. And he said to me, just try a line. He said, and you'll be okay. Just try a line.
Oh,
and I did. I snorted it. And within moments, I felt everything was okay. Everything was okay. And that was in September of 95. And I would do it maybe on weekends in September of 95.
Yeah.
And come December of 95, I got scared that I was starting to get addicted. And one night my husband came home, he had six bags, and I refused to do it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, this broke up my marriage, and we parted, and I took the children. My husband lived with another couple in Revere, and I went over there one day, and he was doing heroin with another friend, and I called this friend a professional junkie. Okay?
Did you get off, Kathy? Did you kick it? Are you off now?
Yes, I am off. What happened was I did do it for a period of time, but I didn't acquire a bad habit. And a friend of mine got me three Suboxones and told me how to take them. And within 3 days, I had kicked. You know, I didn't have a severe habit. And
lucky for you and happened, off and into heroin to deal with the grief of losing a child. I mean, we need other answers than that, but I'm glad you're off, Kathy. I appreciate your call. Dr. Rich, what about this story and how long it takes to become addicted and the different paths people take off of addiction?
So addiction is a combination of genetics, environment, and exposure. There are certainly people with a genetic predisposition. There are certainly people in the right environment. And then if you get exposed. Now, I think we've kind of had this conversation like, oh, my goodness, the heroin just fell from the streets and it's all over the United States. And really what's happened here is there's been a dramatic increase in prescription opiates. The tonnage of opiates poured into our communities through the medical profession has really created, as Liam said, the scourge of his generation.
Under the rubric of pain management.
Well, it's so two things have driven that. You know, one is there's a push to have patient-centered medical care. And as part of that, we've kind of, the profession has been pushed to respond to patient satisfaction, and that's really driven it. The second is the pharmaceutical industry. The profit motive has really, you know, pushed to train doctors to prescribe more and more and more. Now, we're starting to rein that in with prescription monitoring programs, with changing physician practices, and I think we need to do a lot more. We need to do a lot more funding, a lot more research in that area. But at the same time, you know, you take somebody on a prescription opiate and you shut them down, their reptilian brain is going to tell them to go find it, and they can find it in any community. Homo sapien is a smart creature.
And it may be oxy something, or it may be heroin.
Well, they will transition to heroin, and it's like a balloon. You know, you squeeze one end, and the other end's going to pop out.
I mean, smart, but not that smart if that's where we end up. But that's the effect of it. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I've got a book coming out on Amazon next month that features heroin addiction. But I just wanted to talk about drug policy real quick. When my ex-girlfriend was on heroin in Boston, the time lag for signing up for a methadone clinic and actually getting one into one was approximately a year to 2 years.
Wow.
So what people were doing was flying to England. I don't think you could do this anymore, but they were flying to England and seeing this guy named Dr. Love, who would then give them a pint jar of methadone, and they would smuggle that back in, and it was the only way a lot of these people could survive. So I would just say that if this is on the rise again, we need to consider not demonizing this, as most people, like Raven earlier, once they get on, they don't want to be on. They're just trying to figure out how to get off, and if methadone is the answer, and we have to make methadone available. Can I just plug my book?
Okay. Okay.
www.themayhemwrangler.com. It'll be out on Amazon the end of next month.
Okay,
thanks,
Dave. I'm glad you raised policy. Caleb, what about availability of treatment at this point? A year or two to get into a clinic?
Well, I would defer to Dr. Rich in terms of immediate availability. We don't see waits that long. Methadone waiting lists are generally quite a bit shorter than that. Suboxone is a really important modality for people to know about. It's not just in big standalone treatment centers. Mm-hmm. Doctors can now prescribe this.
So your family doctor could help you out with that in the privacy.
That's exactly right. People can ask for that. What they also need to be asking for, though, is they need to be asking for overdose education. They need to learn about how to prevent infectious diseases such as HIV and hepatitis, which are really quite rampant among injection drug users. Mm-hmm. And there's a medication, an antidote to overdoses. Most people don't know that all overdoses can be prevented, and most can be reversed before they become fatal if people know how to recognize an overdose and how to intervene in an overdose and potentially have available with them Narcan, also known as naloxone. And so it's really critical that people be aware of this, because some people can't get into treatment, they're not ready for treatment, they're continuing to use. They may even be chronic pain patients on high-dose opiates with other people in a household. They're in a rural area. Medic response is far away. People who are regular opiate users and their family members have to know the warning signs of overdose and how to respond.
Yeah. Jay in Shelton, Connecticut. Jay, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. There's a million things about this. I'm a survivor. I've been through a 10-year addiction and 3 years clean now. I just want to give a little bit of hope to any of the hopeless out there that you can recover from opiate addiction. Your mind and your body will heal. You have to find the will. It's not easy. But I've been there. People think that, oh, this is it. I'm done. Once an addict, always an addict. No, I'd like to challenge that. It's incredibly difficult. But with enough time and perseverance, your body and your mind does heal.
I'm glad
it's
you made it.
For different people, but it does happen.
Yep.
I think that's important for people to keep in mind once they get themselves clean and they're ready to go right back because they can't sleep or they're a little shaky.
Stick with it.
You've got to give it time.
Stick with it. Jay, I appreciate your call. Jody Rich, given this spread and given the easy availability and the low cost and the kind of predilection created by opiate prescription drugs, how do we start to get a handle on this nationally?
You know, a big driving factor in this is the stigma and shame and the sense that this is not us, this is them, that those are different people. And when you have somebody like Corey die, it's a wake-up call. It says, no, this is not them. This is us. This is our children. This could happen to anybody. And what we need to do is try and address that stigma and the shame. And then we need a multi-level approach. This is early AIDS epidemic. It was those kinds of people that got it. And so the response at the federal, national, local, and state was anemic. And that's where we are now. We really need to ramp up. We need to start with certainly naloxone use. Dan Bigg at Chicago Recovery Alliance really piloted this along with many others and showed that, a very simple training and people can recognize and treat an overdose. So if Corey had a friend or knew that he was addicted and was nearby, knew that he was using and had came upon him, it would be a different story today. But we need a federal response and states. Now, healthcare reform can really do a lot of drug treatment, and we need to push that as well.
That's coming. Caleb Bantegum, we just have a few seconds here. Demonizing the wrong way to go, but you've got to be clear about the dangers or people can just slide right in.
Yeah, but I think it's very clear, and the Obama administration is very clear. We need a public health response. The law enforcement response by its own cannot do this. We need a public health response. We need a medical response. And that's really the direction we need to go in.
Heads up, America. Heroin in too many places, in too many people. Caleb Bantegreen at the University of Washington Medical Center, thank you very much for being with us from Seattle today, Caleb.
Thank you.
And Dr. Josiah Rich at the Miriam Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. Jody Rich, thank you so much.
Thanks for covering this, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.